Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode of How This Is Building Me, host D. Ross Kamage, MD, PhD, of the University of Colorado, sits down with Andrew Weikart, MBBS, FRACP, Doctor of Medical Science, a consultant medical oncologist at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer and Wellness Center and the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Research Institute at Austin Hospital in Melbourne, Australia. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Kamage and Weikart discuss the span of countries and institutions Dr. Weikart's medical training and career has led him to, the ins and outs of becoming a practicing oncologist in Australia versus the United States, and the importance of discerning patient needs and preferences to earn patient trust and deliver effective, personalized care across the globe.
Hello, I'm Ross Kamage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the challenges, triumphs, ups and downs of all those who deal with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. Today, I really want to extend the direction in which we've taken some of these podcasts, and I want to really get an international perspective. And so the direction I'm going to take is, if you'll excuse the expression, down and under, which allows me to introduce my good friend, Dr. Andrew Weikart. Andrew, would you like to introduce yourself in any way that you think is appropriate?
Thanks, Ross. I'm Andrew Weikart, and I'm a medical oncologist that works in Melbourne, Australia. I trained with Ross for a few years, a little over 10 years ago, and I've returned to work in Australia now, working in a large tertiary academic hospital, and I run genitourinary cancer clinical trials and phase one clinical trials, and have a wide area of interest as well in general medicine and hospital physician training, as well as assisting in voluntary assisted dying within our hospital for patients that may request access to it.
Well, we can take that in lots of different directions. Well, let's start off with a little bit of you. So you trained entirely in Australia, and then as I was reminding myself of your CV, there was a brief period of time when you were in the UK in somewhere like Margate, but I can't remember what you were doing there.
Yeah, I did my medical training in Melbourne, which was in the day a straight from high school into 6 years of medicine and 6 years of training at university. It was grueling. I enjoyed it, but I took a year off and before my final year of medicine and traveled doing some work, 3 months in Kenya. And then I did about 4 or 5 months working in Margate, working in the NHS at a local hospital where I was a screening receptionist for a physiotherapy clinic.
So you weren't working as a physician, you were supporting the NHS in a different way.
Correct. It was a great time. And that was in a small seaside town, which, as you mentioned, was called Margate, which back in the day was very run down and dilapidated. But more recently, because of some strange factors involving new and upcoming British artists, and I guess the rejuvenation of these urban areas has become trendy, but not in the day that I was there. So look, that was an interesting experience. I returned after that to finish my medical degree in Melbourne and did what we do here in Australia is to enter physician training or in internal medicine, you do what's called 3 years of basic training. So an intern year, and then a few years as a junior house staff in the hospital with an exam. At the end of that, I completed 3 years of advanced training in medical oncology. So I was technically qualified as a consultant in Australia, had the opportunity to, go and seek jobs as a consultant within a hospital, having finished my degree. But I did 2 years then of lab research, before doing 2 years with you in Denver.
We should point out for those listening from a US perspective that a consultant is an attending. And so, yeah, you could have popped out as a kind of fully qualified medical oncologist, and then you added an extra 4 years for the fun of it, 2 years in the lab and 2 years in the USA.
Yeah, the reason I wanted to do that was, you know, to get experience in the lab. I really Was interested firstly to see whether or not, you know, wet lab research interested me or would be something that I wanted to have as an ongoing part of my career. There's also an advantage in having a higher degree for a CV and getting a job as an attending consultant in Australia. And I really wanted the experience also of working and living overseas. It was something that I've always enjoyed, traveling, and the opportunity to work in the US healthcare system was a pretty attractive one. And it was serendipitous about how that came about. And you and I started working together through a connection based on another doctor that I had trained with in Australia, Ben Solomon. And Ben and you had been working on, you know, a lung cancer phase one clinical trial of crizotinib. And he was aware you were looking for a research fellow. And it was just serendipity that it happened that I was also looking for a US position. And we met up, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I remember the first time I met you, you were terribly serious, which is weird because that's not you at all. But you were on your best interview behavior. I think we was at ASCO.
Yeah, well, it was fortuitous on my behalf, actually working with you in the US system and having you employ me, because I think you realized what my training had consisted of and what my strengths might have been at that time. I had also applied at a few other places and they hadn't employed previous Australian trainees who had completed training. And I think the other hospital systems felt like we should just be slotted back into a training position, which would have been sort of 3 or 4 years back in my view of what I had wanted to do. And so the opportunity to work with you was quite good because I think you had projects and clinical experience that married with what I felt like I could contribute to.
Yeah, I always feel like when you take somebody on, you know when somebody is ready to go off into the world by themselves because they start arguing with you about things. And you started doing that super early. And I kind of, you know, strapped myself in for the ride for 2 years. But that's great. You know, it's not just like you're wrong, but you could say you're wrong because A, B, and C. And, you know, that's why I think you've done so well. So getting a job in Australia, is that like getting a job in America at the end of the day? Or does the government control the jobs? I still haven't quite figured out whether Australia is the National Health Service down under or whether it's some composite of something else.
It's a blend of both the UK and the US healthcare system, where we have parallel public provision of service, which is free to everyone, and large tertiary hospitals are all run in that public service so that free healthcare available to all and you don't need private health insurance. Yet there are smaller private hospitals that offer a similar but stripped down version of service. Some are getting larger and nearing the size of the other public academic hospitals, but that's very uncommon. So for trainees that finish their medical oncology advanced training, the opportunities are in either of those two services, and they can be in both at the same time. So for simplicity, once you have your advanced training, you could go to a private hospital anywhere in Australia, put a sign on the door and say, I am a medical oncologist, and start working or join a practice similar in the US. But you would need people to refer to you, and that's a barrier to entry if you're unknown or not working or haven't been training with people in that area before. But it's not uncommon for people to try that, but it takes a while to build up a private practice. It has been more common for most trainees to want a position in the public academic hospitals because of the ability to work with colleagues on clinical trials, to develop research projects. And that sort of practice, I think, is more consistent with what their training has been. So most trainees will feel like they'll want the support of the public academic system as well. And so most people, once they've finished their training, will not go into purely private practice. That's uncommon, but an opportunity that awaits them. And the difficulty now in Australia is that it's increasingly more difficult to finish your training and just walk into a good public academic role without offering something else, such as having done a research degree or training overseas. Those are sort of the things that now need to be added to the CV to get a position in Australian academic hospitals, because of the growth of positions hasn't married the increase in training numbers.
I wondered whether just the time doing those things, the lab time and then the time in the USA, allowed you to kind of, you know, get in a wait list, sort of a virtual wait list for a public service job in Australia. And then you could say, look, remember that guy Wycott? He was awesome. He's going to come to the front of the line in 2 years.
I think there's certainly an element of that, in that there's recognized experience and time and maturity from doing a few extra years at the end of your advanced training overseas. I also think, apart from the practical skills and knowledge that I gained, there's an element of working overseas that's a bit of a black box of mystery that, for whatever reason, is valued highly.
Like mystery as in like cachet, kind of like, ooh.
Correct, right? People don't know what you do overseas when you return back. You know, there's a list of publications and some skills, and, you know, it's not all hand waving, but some of it's a bit like, ooh, worked in the US for a while. Let's get this person back in. And it looks more impressive than some of what it may actually be. I mean, that's
Reveal that secret. Yeah.
That's not to devalue the very real and practical things that we were able to do and that really helped me. But I say to my trainees, when they ask for advice about working overseas, I say, even if you don't get 20 publications and work with an amazing guy like Ross Camidge, you'll still be able to come back with your CV looking a lot better than it really is by just having worked overseas and having a reference from the person that you worked with saying, you know, Annabelle did an amazing job working with us in, you know,
Margate.
Turin or Margate, that's right.
When you came back, was the goal to, because you brought your family and the three boys over with you for those 2 years, was the goal to find any kind of job that would keep you in Melbourne? Was the goal to land in a particular disease type wherever it was in the country? Because a job is potentially for life in Australia, right? Well, and potentially in the USA too.
Yeah, there was a bit of uncertainty when I returned back home. Certainly, I loved my time in Colorado, and unlike some places in the US, there was an opportunity that we briefly discussed of me staying on for longer at the time in Colorado as an attending. It was an opportunity I hadn't contemplated previously, but I returned back after 2 years because of two things. One, my wife's family, there was some illness from her grandfather's side of the family, and she wanted to be closer at the time, so it was advantageous to return home. And secondly, with the kids at the right age for schooling, she wanted the kids back home. And I think, you know, kids in the Australian education system, I felt a little bit happier with, given some of the potential issues in American schools with gun violence and so forth that, you know, longer term worried me somewhat about living and staying in the US. But when I returned home, I didn't have a solid job opportunity and there was some uncertainty. I knew I wanted a job in Melbourne, and I was pretty happy within 1 to 2 months that a hospital that I worked at had an opportunity. It wasn't in lung cancer, which I'd done a lot of the work in with you, but it was both in phase one clinical trials and genitourinary cancer. And it's interesting how my career sort of pivoted to focus then on genitourinary cancer, which I hadn't done any in the US, but rapidly had to become an expert in Australia. And I do a lot of research in bladder cancer, and there are a lot of similarities between bladder cancer and lung cancer.
Bladder cancer is the lung cancer of the genitourinary system.
Correct. Exactly. A lot of it is smoking related. There's immunotherapy and there's targeted therapy now that's in use in bladder cancer with FGFR inhibitors in a small proportion, but increasing knowledge that we can improve on outcomes for these patients with better small molecule inhibitors. So it's very similar to lung cancer in some ways, and the populations are actually fairly similar as well. So definitely wasn't a wasted experience, and it certainly helped me start developing a research program and feeling confident regarding that when I returned home.
Are you just working in one hospital now, or are you still working in the private sector as well?
Yeah, so my employment is 80% in a large public hospital, so 4 days a week, almost 4.5 days a week. I'm full-time in this large academic hospital.
And we should point out it's the Olivia Newton-John Health and Wellness Centre, is that what it's called?
Yeah, Olivia Newton-John Cancer and Wellness Centre, and that's based at a hospital called the Austin Hospital. So it's a bit of a mouthful. I guess you're used to that with Anschutz Medical Centre, University of Colorado, etc.
That's true. But I don't have a picture standing next to, you know, her Sandra Dinas that like you do.
Yeah, well, Olivia visited often for fundraising for the hospital, and she was an amazing person because she was actually very personable, spent a lot of time with the patients without media following her around. She campaigned and raised a lot of money for the Wellness Center, which offers meditation, psychological support services, massages as a component to what we offer. And I think patients do value that. She wouldn't put her name on the building without that being a component. The role, getting back to where I stand, I do a day a week seeing patients in a private clinic, and those patients, if they're unwell, will get admitted to a private hospital across the road from my public hospital. So they're sort of, I just need to cross the road. So geographically, I'm in the same place 5 days a week. Essentially, just a road separates 1 day a week where I work.
One of the things I've realized, that, I mean, you're being very modest, but you know, you're actually very well known, I think, in the bladder cancer field. But one question I wanted to ask is, I mean, you know, we're talking over Zoom across thousands of miles. Maybe the distance doesn't matter, but in Australia, when you look for a kind of academic peer group, do you look to Europe? Do you look to, you know, Asia Pacific countries? Do you look to the, you know, the Americas? I mean, or I mean, you could say, no, we don't have to look anywhere. We're fabulous in Australia. But I mean, where is your international travel normally directed?
I was lucky when I returned to Australia that they had a cooperative trials group, I guess a bit like SWOG or any of the larger cooperative groups, that was being set up and was in its infancy in Australia. And that was led by a mentor of mine, Ian Davis, who had started this trials group with a few other people and developed a program to support clinical trial research. So when I returned a bit over 10 years ago, they were very helpful in setting up and assisting me in developing a trial, looking at the role of pembrolizumab with chemoradiation in bladder cancer. So in setting that trial up, initially the support was from that local cooperative group was brilliant. And I didn't know any international, you know, big stars and so forth, but being able to set that trial up and get funding for that from MSD and Merck was fantastic, because that then enabled me to have this trial recruiting, got some recognition in terms of being a pivotal sort of phase 1-2 safety trial that was going to give some signal as well of activity. But that then did link me with a larger group of bigwigs and hotshots from the US and Europe. And I think there's a widespread of people, key opinion leaders and people who are the real stars, and it's not me for sure, but that drive the output and research. But through setting up that trial locally with that cooperative group, it did sort of connect me more widely, and you know, led to some great experiences and being able to discuss the research with those people and get some recognition.
You have experience of doing research in the USA and of doing research in Australia. Are they equally problematic? Are they equally easy to do? I mean, you have a unique sort of dual view of the world.
Yeah, I think it's all about the infrastructure around you as a researcher, and both can be good and both can be problematic in the US. And it normally comes down to money to support them. And that money can be difficult to find depending on where you work. So those sort of large research grants that in the US are increasingly more and more competitive the same environment in Australia exists, where we have a what's called an NHMRC, a National Health and Research Council, that gives large grants like an R01, et cetera. And the funding line has dropped to, you know, very tight levels. And those research grants are very difficult to come by still, and would elude me by myself without having a good team to work with. There are, though, a lot of philanthropic organisations that have grants that are able to be applied for. And working in a large academic hospital, there's often a little bit of meat still on the bone of other research that allows some projects to get going and seed funding to be developed. We're very lucky as well that our cooperative group came up with a good idea a few years back with some fundraising where, you know, they may get about $1 million a year, a little less in fundraising, but they then put that into research and they put it into seed projects where for $50,000 for funding a project that offers, you know, the beginning of a research project and preliminary data. So I've launched a few of those research projects that have been really useful. And I'm not sure what it's like in the US at the moment for those sort of smaller pots of money, but they've been pivotal to try and build up the beginnings of larger research plans.
One of the things about, you know, classic grant-funded research is it's always presented as, you know, where is this going to lead to? Which I get that. It's kind of like, you know, what's the bang for my buck from the kind of funder's perspective? But I do think there are other projects which have got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And they're actually really hard to get funded because it's like, well, okay, you get the answer, but then what? And you go, but we have the answer. And so some of the stuff that you and I did together is what I'm most proud of because, you know, we just did it on a wing and a prayer and we didn't worry about grant funding. We just did it because it was really interesting. I should point out to those people listening. So Andrew and I wrote the first ever paper on what has now become a recognized term of oligoprogression. So that word didn't exist before, but the idea that somebody could be on a treatment and only a small areas of disease were growing on the treatment, and then you zapped it with radiotherapy and you stayed on the treatment. And, you know, that became standard of care here after people throwing rocks at us for a few years, but it's now the standard of care. Is it the standard of care in GU cancer?
Yeah, so certainly for kidney cancer, that's a commonly accepted way to treat oligoprogressive disease would be using stereotactic radiation and so forth. Prostate cancer, in some circumstances, and there are trials now investigating that. Bladder cancer, it's less common because the disease seems a bit more widespread, but it's certainly in prostate and kidney cancer, yes, for sure.
I mean, it's also a reflection of how effective the systemic therapy is. So, you know, if you can't control most of the disease, then you don't get oligoprogression. You just, you know, it's all on or it's all off.
Yeah, no, that's right. So I think one of the best things about working with you was that nimble attitude of here's some observations we've had from, you know, this group of patients. Let's try and, you know, systematically look at that, characterize it and report it. And as you say, that sort of research, it can be done without necessarily a large amount of funding, but it can be quite pivotal in driving forward practice.
And there's no reason why you can't do that at Olivia Newton-John, though, is there? You know, somebody said, you know, a few years ago that movies are going to be made on an iPhone. I do think the ability to transform the world with relatively small observations in a molecularly uniform population, given that we're profiling our patients, has become easier. And so you can have a breakthrough that comes from, it doesn't have to be an ivory tower. It can be, you know, a shack in the back of summer, as long as they're doing good research.
Yeah, exactly. I think those research projects, though, begin with observation and characterization of something that adds value to the field. One of the research projects that's common for our trainees to want to come and do is always, you know, starts though with a wider promise, and I want them to focus down. And I'm always laughing with the trainees at the end of our discussion because I always talk about something that you brought up when I was working with you, when you were talking about reviewing abstracts. If for ASCO 1 year. And I asked, you know, what sort of research is it, you know, that's being presented? And he said, oh, if I ever have to read another paper or abstract that's, you know, allotinib in EGFR mutant patients, the Turkish experience, you know, I'm going to quit.
Substitute your whichever country that won't offend you here, but yes.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so I have trainees come and say to me, I want to, you know, report on how we're treating prostate cancer with this combination of drugs. And I always say, the Olivia Newton-John experience, you know. It's been written about before. So what are we adding to the field here apart from...
Well, you have Olivia Newton-John's name on it, which, you know, I would read it.
No, it's... I think you've got to be careful with trainees that want to do research and are, you know, genuinely interested in trying to obviously report on what they're seeing because they think it's interesting. You've got to be careful that they don't begin research projects that are dead ends, that don't add anything or are very similar to 10 other research reports that have done things before. So I always try and say, you know, what question are you trying to answer here? Is what unique aspect of the research, the retrospective case reports, are you bringing? And I think what I always reflect on is when I was at, you know, University of Colorado with you, was that you had these observations like, you know, low testosterone that you were seeing in men and that it hadn't been reported on, and were able to then, with a wider number of patients, we could test patients and make some observations that were novel, you know, the renal change in renal function, for instance.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. This is all with crizotinib, yeah.
Yeah, with crizotinib. So these observations, I think, you want to make and then drive forward with a question that is going to add value rather than just doing research for research sake, because nothing bores me more than just a report, a Me Too report of 10 patients from, you know, a center.
It's funny because the other thing about testosterone and renal function issue with crizotinib was it's the size of the effect. So when you have a big size of an effect, you can get away with a relatively small number of patients. So I think when you wrote up the first, you know, crizotinib drops men's testosterone paper, you know, it was like present in like 90% of people or something. I mean, it was pretty dramatic. So, mm-hmm. you know, after you'd done 20 patients, you already knew the answer. It's really funny because Pfizer then did a follow-up study where they reported the incidence was 2%, but that's because they didn't actually check testosterone in men. They included in the numerator those where it was checked and it was low, and then the denominator, everyone who was in the trial, including both men and women. So it's like, you know, how to throw some confusion into the field if you don't want the result that is actually true.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Tell me about, you know, what the Weikart family is like now.
Yeah, so I'm married to Bianca, who's a speech pathologist and works a few days a week and is an amazing mother to three boys. I grew up with two brothers. So now I have three sons, their age between 16 to 9. I wasn't sure that I wanted to have a third child. And then funnily enough, when I returned to Australia and finally secured a position that seemed like I was in a settled position back here in Melbourne, I was invited to go to South Korea on a conference. And it was a pharmaceutical drug trial investigators meeting. That's what it was. And yeah. I was flying back from Seoul business class, having a few wines, and I thought, I reckon life's good enough to have a third child. And if it hadn't been for that one investigators meeting in South Korea, maybe that third child may not have come. So we do joke that Darcy's, who's my third child, his nickname actually is Sol.
I was going to be named after the drug company, but there we go.
Yeah, well, that's right. So, yeah, no, we've got a healthy, active family, and I feel blessed, and they keep me very much grounded.
One of the things that's always fascinating is, you know, there you are, you know, Australians are sort of famously laid back and, you know, easygoing. What are patients in the US like from your perspective compared to Australian patients? Is communication, is informed consent kind of like, yeah, that sounds about right, you know?
Yeah, I think in the US, the system when I was working there did seem like it was a little more formal than here in Australia. But that may have been because of a socioeconomic group that I dealt with in the US. And maybe it's different in different areas. So in Australia, my hospital services a population with a lot of immigrants, non-English speaking, and, you know, retired factory workers who are very comfortable with, I'm going to call it paternalistic medicine, but, you know, feel more comfortable with the doctor in charge providing them with informed consent that may be abbreviated compared to when in the US I was working with a population in Colorado that was seeing you that had a higher education level and wanted a greater degree of detail, had done their own research, were on social media, you know, had discussed with their social media group what their next treatment should be and which trial and where to get it. They were quite different, and I love looking after both groups of populations, and I love also meeting new patients and trying to work out which approach works best.
When you had to go in and see the patients before me, which for somebody who is as, you know, smart and talented as you, probably sort of seemed slightly redundant, then I would sort of come in and was like, well, who's this guy coming in at the end? Did you find that frustrating?
Yeah, we had a system, right, where I would see the patient and then you would come in. It was good, actually, because for some years, you know, I had worked independently, but you don't have someone coming in after you to check or then observe how they interact with a patient. And I think I learned a lot from that. And I think in training and as physicians, we often don't have that ability to reflect or observe as much as we probably should. So it was a useful learning experience. And, you know, I think about sometimes when, you know, for instance, with the patients, they might have said something to you like, you know, oh, Andrew was a bit serious today or so forth. And you would say something to me like, you know, Andrew, you know, you were so relaxed outside, but then you were quite serious, you know, and then I could see how you would interact with the patient and, you know, be warm and bubbly and enthusiastic.
I've never been called bubbly, but thank you.
No, I think you can be. And I think you do have a warm connection with the patients that you look after. So seeing that and being able to model or change the way I interact with patients, I sometimes think about that when I see patients and I try and work out how to engage them and so forth. So that was valuable.
Didn't you have a particularly rude description of your role of seeing the patient before me? Do you remember what you called them?
A fluffer.
Yeah. And so for all those people who now have to Google what that is, do enjoy that when you do that.
Just getting them warmed up for the hot shot. Yeah, that was, look, it was a funny experience because it was slightly different, but I learned a lot from it for sure.
My favorite bit was we got into the habit of, you know, I would go in and part of explaining complex issues, I would often use analogies, and because I get bored easily, I would try and do a different analogy each time. And then you started like trying to out analogy me.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I remember that well. And in fact, I often still try and create analogies on the run with patients. And I just stop myself and think, oh God, where is this going? Can I execute this analogy well enough?
Yeah, I know. So, you know, as I was driving in, I thought, okay, so, you know, what is a good analogy like?
Okay, yeah.
That's a joke. You have to think about that one. You've given us a wonderful insight in terms of, you know, what life is like, at least from our perspective on the other side of the world. But what does Andrew Weikart want to be doing in the next few years, both in terms of your life CV, you know, so, you know, father of three boys and having a good family life there in Melbourne, and also kind of work CV as well?
I think in the job we have looking after very sick patients who have their life cut short, it makes me realize that we need to be very balanced because our opportunities, you know, for spending time with family might be limited. And that's influenced me a lot about thinking about setting up career and balance of life outside work. So For me, the next, you know, 5-10 year horizon, I always look at it as trying to get that balance right and not being too career focused. That's less important than it used to be, because I think I see now how potentially limited life can be. So seize the moment and ensure that I can spend as much time on weekends and after work hours with my family to enjoy, and friends to enjoy the outdoor life, hiking, golf, cycling, you know, traveling with my wife and so forth. And I've actually cut back the amount of research time I do outside work hours for that reason. But from a research position and career at work, I love to be challenged and involved. And I, in the next 5-10 years, want to grow my clinical trial research in cooperative group trials that we set up here in Australia. And I'm focused on doing that through the cooperative group I mentioned earlier. But fundamentally, what gives me the most enjoyment in my career is setting up and mentoring the careers of others. You know, I've been fortunate to have worked with people like you and other people that have taken the time with my career. And, you know, I have a great position. I love my position and work, but I want to be able to be remembered as someone that took the time for other people's careers. So mentoring, teaching, supervision, and setting up research projects for other people is the most important thing about my career at the moment. So, you know, any research opportunity I have, I'd rather put someone else as the first author or the last author if that helps them, because I don't really need to be recognized any further to derive professional satisfaction. I don't need to, you know, have that publication on my CV to give me an opportunity. And if I can help other people do that and get a job for it that sets them up, that would make me happy.
You know, just hearing you say that, that makes me so proud. Because, so two things. So one is, I think if we don't live our lives, then, you know, we miss out on the opportunity of sharing that humanity with our patients. And, you know, people want to be treated by another human being. They don't want to be treated by a robot. And then the other is our legacy, for want of a better word, will last so much longer than, you know, whatever the citation index of whatever your paper is. So thank you for making me proud. Andrew, it's been a great pleasure. Always fun to catch up with you.
It's been great. Thanks, Ross.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at EnclaveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.